This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The message is beginning to get through that we have to leave some stuff in the ground.
The drawn-out fight to prevent the Keystone XL pipeline recently ended in a triumph for environmental activists when President Obama announced he would not approve the pipeline. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with the leader of the movement to stop the Keystone XL, Bill McKibben. He and I discuss the importance of the movement to prevent the pipeline's construction, what the recent victory means for the environmental movement in a larger sense, and whom among the current presidential candidates McKibben thinks is best on the environment. Then we revisit my discussion with entrepreneur Harrison Dillon, the co-founder of Solazyme, a biotech company that creates environmentally friendly synthetic designer oils that can be used in a wide array of products that have traditionally been petroleum-based. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Bill McKibben. Bill, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
What a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's an auspicious time to speak to you. Last time we spoke, you were just in kind of the early stages of fighting the Keystone XL pipeline. And last week, President Barack Obama finally decided to not allow the pipeline to get built. Can you first take us back to the beginning of your efforts to stop the pipeline, Bill? There were so many important causes to tackle. There still are. But why this one?
Well, this was important because there's so much carbon up in the tar sands in Canada. Jim Hansen at NASA, our greatest climatologist, said in 2011 that if you pumped all the oil out of the tar sands up there, it would be game over for the climate. So that's why we went to work on this. And, at the time, it seemed like a lost cause, that this pipeline was a done deal, because every other pipeline that's ever been proposed has gotten built. But we decided we would take it on anyway. And before long, we'd had the largest civil disobedience action on anything in this country in 30 years, and more emails sent to the Senate on a single topic in a single day, and more public comments, several million, on an infrastructure proposal than any time else in U.S. history. And before long, there was a real chance. More to the point, before long, people were taking the lessons from Keystone and using them all over the country and all over the world. There's now this spirited resistance to every kind of fossil fuel project everywhere you can imagine. Just this morning, Governor Cuomo, after a long fight in New York, announced that he was canceling plans for a huge liquefied natural gas container port off the coast of Long Island. He banned fracking in the state the year before. You know, we've blocked drilling in the Arctic, on and on and on. It's been a long, long series of remarkable victories now.
Beyond the warnings from people like Dr. James Hansen, personally, was there a kind of a light bulb moment that went off for you and said, this cannot happen as long as I'm part of the environmental movement? This is where I want to really focus my energies.
Well, it seemed like a remarkably important fight. And there was such great leadership from indigenous people up in Alberta, really on both sides of the border, and from farmers and ranchers in Nebraska. It was of a different order than other things. And so it was a great pleasure to get to throw in with everyone.
And what do you think was the turning point in terms of the political process?
I think the sheer number of people and their passion that that mobilized was what produced this result. Look, left to its own devices, money wins every time. And they had all the money. But we didn't leave them to their own devices.
Explain to listeners who aren't really familiar with the fuzzy math that went behind the proponents of the Keystone XL pipeline and the canard of this big job creation.
Oh, well, as usual, the fossil fuel industry said, oh, we're going to create, at various times it was hundreds of thousands or millions of jobs. And I mean, that was obviously ludicrous to anyone who stopped to think about it even for a minute. I mean, the reason that you build a pipeline is so that no one will have to do any work to get the oil out. By the time they were done, they were forced to confess that there would be 35 full-time jobs on this pipeline. So, you know, the sort of equivalent of a medium-sized fast food restaurant someplace.
Explain how this pipeline being stopped is more than just the Keystone XL pipeline. How is this a sign that good sense is maybe winning the day?
Well, earlier this year, the head of one of the big fossil fuel industry groups said in a speech to his peers, said ruefully, "We have to figure out how to stop the Keystoneization of every project out there." And I think that's to me, the real signal that we're getting somewhere.
Once you're a verb, huh?
Yes. It's very clear that there's going to be none of this stuff for free anymore. It's going to be a fight everywhere that they want to do it. And that's precisely what we need. The message is beginning to get through that we have to leave some stuff in the ground. And even the president said used that phrase when he announced his veto of the pipeline.
And another effort that you've been at the forefront of, Bill, is fossil fuel divestment. It's an idea that seems to be picking up steam, doesn't it?
Yes, it's gone better than we expected. I think we're up to $2.6 trillion in assets, in endowments and portfolios that have divested. I don't really know what $1 trillion is, but it sounds like serious money anyway.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah, and so we're, again, we think the point that's really gotten across is the one we were trying to make at the beginning, that these companies are rogue companies, that their business plans call for burning far more carbon than any scientist thinks is safe. And that math, the math we first laid out as we started this divestment campaign, is now the math of, you know, the World Bank and the IMF and the Bank of England and Deutsche Bank and all the other serious players. It's become the conventional wisdom, and very quickly.
How does it work logistically? If I were a student listening right now to See Change Radio on my college radio station, and I wanted to know, hey, does my university invest their endowment in fossil fuel companies? How would I check that? And if they were doing it, how would I fight back?
Well, first thing you do is look around your university, because chances are there's already a divestment campaign underway. Most major colleges and universities in the country, that's true of. But you could go to gofossilfree.org, and there'd be laid out there for you all the steps that people have taken all across the world. We know how to do this now, how to figure out what you're invested in and how to do something about it. And there's a great collaborative effort all over the world.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to environmentalist and author Bill McKibben. So, Bill, you've said that Exxon is the next step in fighting climate change. We've had some people discussing what Exxon did back in the 80s and how they knew that climate change was happening well before many of us did, and did nothing to alert the public. In fact, did the opposite. Can you expand on why you think this is the next step when we're looking back, you know, 30 years to what Exxon did? Why is this important moving forward?
We've always thought that an important part of this fight was to weaken the power of the fossil fuel companies. Nothing takes away from their legitimacy like the emerging picture of the biggest of the fossil fuel companies as a deceiver. They knew everything there was to know about climate change 30 years ago. And then instead of sharing that information straightforwardly with the world, they set up an infinite number of climate front groups and denier operations and coalitions of fossil fuel industry and stuff to try and pretend to people that there was great doubt and uncertainty, when in fact they were using that very information to buy leases in the Arctic that land they knew would melt, and on and on and on. So I think this is actually very powerful. I think that the more that this news spreads, the weaker their ability to continue to impede progress on climate change.
And how does this translate to action? The information coming out recently about Exxon and what they knew back in the early 80s. How does this inform you and your colleagues' activities?
All over the country now, people are doing things like staging sit-ins at gas stations and just spreading the word, letting everyone know. So far, the New York Attorney General has announced plans for a big investigation of Exxon on these claims. We're hopeful that the Department of Justice will follow suit at some point.
And when we look at efforts to drill in the Arctic being waylaid, a lot of oil industry analysts see this as more of a bellwether, or it's more influenced by lower oil prices than anything. Do you see it that way, though?
I think that Shell found, they may have found less oil than they expected, but they definitely found more trouble than they wanted when they started to head north to drill. The kayaktivists and others in Portland and Seattle gave that company a black eye it won't soon get over.
I don't know how closely you've been following the presidential election, but which of the presidential candidates right now do you think will do the most to protect the environment?
Well, I know best and support most my home state senator, Bernie Sanders. He's been in the absolute forefront of the environmental fight for a very long time. When we wanted help on Keystone, he was the first senator to come out strong and do the right thing. Been a remarkable voice.
Bill McKibben, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thank you so much.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my good friend Harrison Dillon. He's an entrepreneur and the co-founder of Solazyme. Harrison, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Great to be here.
So why don't you go back for us to your grad school days and tell us how Solazyme emerged. And also I should mention from the get-go that you no longer actively work at Solazyme, so you're not speaking on behalf of the company.
Sure. So I actually became fascinated with genetics all the way back in boarding school and went through college as a biology major and working in a lab. And that was my first experience in microbial genetics, was as an undergrad at Emory, learning how to clone genes out of bacteria. And then in grad school, I was doing my doctorate in genetics and had some ideas about how one could use genetics not for human health, which was the focus in the mid-90s as the Human Genome Project was ramping up. But how to use genetics for other things, industrial things, and in particular, renewable energy was really interesting to me. And so some of the original ideas around Solazyme involved how one could use genetics to engineer microbes that make stuff that's flammable to make things like biofuels very efficiently and cost-effectively, and algae ended up looking like the platform that we wanted to use. And after grad school, I became a patent attorney, moved to Silicon Valley, and eventually started the company with a co-founder in a garage about 12 years ago and built the company from there.
And what is the company for listeners who aren't familiar with Solazyme?
Solazyme is an industrial biotechnology company that uses microalgae to manufacture a whole suite of products, ranging from designer renewable oils to food products to cosmetics even. There's a whole cosmetic line called Alginist that's in several thousand Sephora stores across the world. So what we did at Solazyme was build a platform that could commercialize algae manufactured through large-scale fermentation. And the products have gone into a lot of different sectors. And I was there about 10 years and left about a year and a half ago after a decade of building the company, and have sort of taken a breather and gotten into some new things as well.
And I want to get into that maybe in a separate discussion, but walk us back to those early days a little bit more, if you will. Beyond the whole raising money through venture capital and pitching people on the idea, what was it like to go from whiteboard to seeing it into a finished product?
Well, it was very satisfying to see these products on the market. And you can really appreciate how much work it took to get those things on the market when you've been working on them for years and years, really at first as a concept and then as a prototype, and then you make more and more changes along the way, and finally it finds its home as a product on the shelf. And really, I think that experience, it was very impactful in that when I walk into a store today or I see any kind of finished product today that's sitting there taking up space, getting bought by people and performing a use for people that they're willing to pay for, I really have full appreciation for how much work it took to get it there, because, you know, we buy things every day and don't think that much about what it took to get these products to the stage where we're buying them. But it is a long, difficult, trying process.
So there's probably several light bulb moments that you can look back and think about. Why don't you try to highlight for our listeners a few of them from when you and your partner, Jonathan, had this idea and were like, we're going to do this, to a few of these moments along the way where it was actually happening.
I can give you a few examples. One is that we were originally focused on using algae to manufacture hydrogen gas. That was really the first thing that we tried. And
that would be used for?
That would be used mainly as a fuel, but also to generate electricity. And what we realized as we really started working out the details for how we were going to get there, we realized that hydrogen as a fuel has basically no infrastructure available to support it. So there are no hydrogen gas stations to speak of. There are, you know, fuel cell cars are really just experimental. There were no distribution networks. And even if we could have made hydrogen at a very low price, there just wasn't the infrastructure to support the use of it.
Yeah, it's really outlined very clearly in Who Killed the Electric Car. They have a whole piece on what about hydrogen, and they kind of show you why it didn't really take off.
Right, right.
Or so hasn't yet, at least.
That was something that we abandoned pretty early on, and then we started making oil using algae, which is another thing that algae can make. And we were originally thinking of ourselves just as a biofuel company, but a pretty big aha moment for us came when we realized that we shouldn't think of ourselves as a fuel company, because fuel wasn't really what we made. What we made was oil. And what we had developed is a process for designing the oil to be ideal for each product you want to make, whether it's a bar of soap or a lubricant or a biofuel or a cooking oil. Oils are there are many, many different types of oil, and we had a custom process for designing oils. And we decided that really what we were was a designer oil company who could make things that go into any product made from oil and not a biofuel company.
So surfactants for cleaning and those kind of other?
On and on and on. Industrial lubricants, plastic materials, just tons of different applications for the technology. And once we stopped thinking of ourselves as a biofuel company and really as a designer oil company, it forced a change in the way we were going to market that was pretty big for us.
Talk about the laboratory process and the actual physical challenges that you and your colleagues faced starting up.
you know, I still remember when we made our very first sample of oil. It was a Herculean effort, and it took, I don't know, a couple of months, and we ended up with, you know, maybe a milliliter or two of oil. So it was just, it was a very inefficient process. We were growing the oil in a pond.
You mean growing algae in a pond?
We were growing the algae in a pond, and that, which is not a very optimal process, and then extracting the oil out of the algae, and it was just a very difficult process, and the amount of oil we got was just tiny. And another big change that we made along the way was we switched our manufacturing method from growing the algae in a pond to growing the algae in a fermenter, which are really two fundamentally different ways to grow the algae. And what we discovered is that the cost of making the oil through fermentation was orders of magnitude lower than from growing the algae in an outdoor pond.
Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the co-founder of Solazyme, Harrison Dillon. So you have that first little milliliter or two of oil. What's the next hurdle of producing something that you could then show investors?
Well, I remember a meeting at one of the oil majors where we walked in with a liter of oil. This was probably a year after we had made the tiny sample. And we, for dramatic effect, we had the bottle of oil sitting on the conference room table at the oil company. And
sorry to interrupt, but the reason for this meeting was you wanted them to potentially invest in the company?
We wanted them to partner with us on the research as well as invest in the company. And, you know, the first thing they told us is sometimes people walk in here with a jar of soy sauce. And so we need to see if you guys are for real.
Oh, they didn't believe you.
Apparently people have walked in there with soy sauce before. But you know, we sold them a sample, and then I'd say a really big moment for us was when we started doing business with the U.S. Military, who has a strategic interest in alternatives to petroleum. But they want not only alternatives to petroleum, but they want the same exact fuel. And so what we proved to the Department of Defense with what was initially about a 5-gallon sample was that, through a totally renewable process, that we could manufacture fuels that were chemically identical to the fuels that already worked in all of their ships and tanks and aircraft. And that was a big moment for us because we really proved to them that we could make fuels that were drop-in compatible with all of their hardware. And that was the beginning of a good working relationship we had with the military.
With plunging oil prices over the last year, Harrison, a lot of these companies in the alternative fuels or alternative oil product segments have scaled back on trying to compete with the ExxonMobils of the world. Where do you see their niche? Or where are these companies placing their bets?
So using industrial biotechnology, you know, fermentation technologies with microbes, you can make many different molecules that have a lot of different uses in various sectors, from fuels to chemicals to materials and foods. It goes on and on. The fuels is a sector where you have to make the material at the very highest volumes that anything is made on Earth, and you're typically operating at pretty low margins. So fuel tends to be sort of farther out than a lot of other sectors where companies that use these types of technologies can go. So for example, in specialty chemicals, the margins are better. You can get higher prices for the materials. In food products, these are higher value materials. And so I think what people have learned over the years in developing these technologies is that it's hard to go after fuel right out of the gate, and that going after smaller volume, higher margin materials is a strategy that not only makes sense, it sort of may be the only way to get there. And, you know, when you look at the petroleum industry and the volumes that these companies are producing, they're absolutely enormous. But you also have to remember that this is an industry that's more than 100 years old. And the amount of investment that's gone in is staggering. So it's hard to compete on a very short timeline with what these companies have been making for decades and decades and decades.
So Harrison, let's get into the science of it. The microbial genetics were what attracted you to the industry. Anybody who's heard a State of the Union speech from George Bush through Barack Obama has heard cellulosic fuel, wood chips, sugar, cane, algae. What's succeeding in the industry, and what's kind of becoming prohibitively expensive? Where are the trends going in terms of what's known as feedstocks?
The use of cellulosic feedstocks has been more challenging than people have realized earlier on. And it's just a nut that's very hard to crack, and people just haven't quite gotten there yet, which is it's unfortunate, because cellulosic material is available at very, very large quantities. When you look at the amount of plant material that's not food, that's produced as, you know, a waste product, or is just generally available, it's huge amounts of material. But the process to turn that raw material into usable fermentable sugar that microbes can metabolize and turn into useful molecules, the price of that conversion process has really been prohibitive. And
at scale that we're talking about.
Right? That's right. And there are some facilities that are using cellulosic materials that are operational now, but it's not very many. And whether or not those are profitable, I think, is an open question right now. So the cellulosic stuff has been, I think, just a lot harder than people had initially realized. But what you can do with technologies that effectively convert more simple and pure forms of sugar is develop the technologies today on simpler sugars that are more purified, and then convert those to cellulosics as the cellulosic technology becomes available over time.
Harrison Dillon, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Great to be here, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to SeaChange Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Ernest Ranglin, the Allman Brothers Band, and Dr. John.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.